The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and glad you could be with me this evening of February 17th, 2014. It is President's Day in the United States, and also George Washington's birthday, so I understand. I read it on the internet, so it must be true. That it was George Washington's birthday. We know it's President's Day. It was a holiday of sorts, and they bumped George off the schedule of holidays of in order to make it for all presidents, which I always say was a big mistake because so many presidents don't deserve to be honored, but what they're doing is honoring the office of president, so we're supposed to just think that whoever is president is, you know, we're supposed to respect the office rather than the man, you know, rather than look too closely at the man. But anyway, that's another, it seems like I've already announced so many President's Days. I must be on this, be doing this program for quite a few years now. My guest tonight is someone familiar to all and who has joined me on the Heretics Hour before. He is the globe-trotting revisionist from the Down Under continent of Australia, Dr. Frederick Toobin. Welcome, Frederick.
Good afternoon or good evening to you. As usual, it's just after midday in Adelaide, but we're one day ahead. It's the 18th. It's Tuesday lunchtime, and it is a great pleasure that I am appearing on your program, Carolyn.
Oh, you are such a gentleman. I wanted to talk for just a moment about how to pronounce your name, because from my understanding of the O-E, it would be Toobin.
Yeah, the O-E is, of course, the O-umlaut split. And usually, I remember the Anglo world didn't know what an umlaut was, so we simply dropped it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't then switch over as others did if there was an umlaut in their name, like Zündel. Zündel, he also stayed Zündel, but then now with the communications through the internet and so on, there are many people familiar with the German umlaut, and therefore we stayed with Toobin, T-O-B-E-N, which is the Irish branch, I think, T-O-B-I-N, but I've gone back to the T-O-B-E-N with the umlaut and not the T-O-E-B-E-N. And the internet addresses, I think, initially or still do not cope with the umlaut.
Right. Well, I notice I've seen it even seemingly by you both ways, or I don't know that it was by you, but and with the umlaut and without the umlaut. And so I thought maybe you had dropped it like Zündel had dropped his. But you just said you've gone back to it. And I know a lot of people add it. They just, I see it that way more than I see it without. I don't have it on, I didn't have it on the announcement for tonight's show because every time I tried to add it, it wouldn't do it. It just, you know, shunted me off somewhere else. So I finally gave up. I didn't know what was going on. I guess once I had it on there.
Yeah, you then have to get the character map and get it out of that one.
Yeah. Well, I know how to do it, but I guess I needed to do it before I put it on the
yeah, but it doesn't matter. As I said, it's Toobin or in the German.
But you just pronounce it Toobin. You don't go to that Toobin.
Toobin is that's the anglicized, the adapted, or in the German it's Toobin. Because in the German Toobin, T-O-B-E-N, to Toobin is to cause uproar, to if you're angry, you are Toobin. You'll thump your fists on the table and things like that. That's Toobin. So if, as a young fellow, I would say, if I don't get my way, I'll start Toobin.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's
so there we are. Bit of a joke.
Speaking of the time, you're so right. You know that many listeners are from around the world. But I since I'm here and it's nighttime, I just think in those terms and I talk about it that way. But yes, so for those listeners who are in Australia, this show is being done on the 18th, and it's noon and one half hour.
But that's only Adelaide, because Adelaide is 1.5 hour behind. Sydney is already 1 o'clock.
Okay, yeah, that
Sydney,
would really
Brisbane and Melbourne, and Perth is 2 hours behind the East Coast. We've got the East Coast, West Coast, 2 hour difference, and Adelaide and the Northern Territory, these two states have their own time zone.
Yeah, is that not confusing? Why are there all these times? Well, we have time zones, but they're not, they're based on the hour, not on the half hour.
Yeah, it gets worse with the daylight saving. We have about 5 different time zones. But it's understandable in some respects, because Queensland is near the tropics. Therefore, the day is 12 hours and the night is 12 hours. While we're moving down south, for example, in Launceston or Hobart, the evenings during the summer very, very long. Of course, in the Antarctic, it's 24 hours a day daylight. So it does make sense to change the time, but then again, it's moving against natural processes.
Well, of course, that's why, because of where you're located, that's why you have to have all those time zones. But yes, I agree. I don't like to change. Even changing your clock 1 hour makes a big difference for quite a long time before you get used to it.
Yeah, and isn't it amazing? You know, even now I've tested myself again, and waking up this morning, I would set the alarm for 6 o'clock, and at 6:03, I would wake up. So the internal clock is still functioning. And I mean, I'm still amazed that such things occur.
Oh, yeah. Internal clocks in us are very strong, I think. I always, if I think I want to wake up at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning, I do. I mean, it's just amazing, you know. I mean, you don't really need these clocks. And I never put on an alarm anymore. I just sleep until I wake up, because I don't have to go anywhere. So I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. And you know, if we talk about that internal clock, we can talk about other internal processes, such as thought processes, that are within us. In other words, this enables us, if we recognize this, that there is an internal structure, a genetic biological structure, that is a given. It's like a tree growing, and it will grow according to its rules and regulations. And I find that with this whole business of Holocaust and historical records and so on, these natural processes are subverted or even perverted through rationalism. But anyway.
Okay, well, maybe we'll get into that more. You always get into the deep thinking, Frederick. I like your statement that you've been using a lot, that Holocaust belief is an expression of racial hatred against Germans. When I saw that, I thought, oh, that's good. That's good. And this should be said. This should be used by all of us who question the Holocaust belief. And make that point, because it is. It's if they want to talk about racial hatred, this is the thing that's so tiresome about Jews. Always going on and on about how people hate them and they shouldn't be allowed to. I always find that so humorous, that they want to stop people from hating them, as though, you know, they're going to legislate against it. But that's what Holocaust belief is. So if you want to say a little bit more about that and how you came up with that.
Yeah, I, you know, throughout my 20 years of being tried in court and so on, I initially accepted the challenge, and in fact, I think I could say that I certainly provoked and welcomed the challenge, because with my philosophical training, I didn't shy away from any debate or from any exploration of thoughts that for some were problematic or even upsetting. When people say, oh, they're upset when they hear something. Now, as a teacher, I would say to students, if they got upset about something, I'd say, don't let yourself be upset. Just grow up a bit and see what is being said. In other words, analyze what sort of upsets you.
Well, yeah. Of course, they don't want to do that because they use it for political means to strengthen their position. So they're really not interested in, Frederick, in understanding this. That doesn't interest them in the least. They don't even want other people to understand it. They want it to be just a they want to have the right to be offended in extreme ways, right? Which is what makes me so angry. You know, I'm sick of it, if you want to know. We're going to talk about a few things tonight here, and I about have no patience left. I feel like you are someone who can still, you get into conversations with Jewish people. I'll be nice and say it that way. And you write letters to them, and you write emails to them, and you want to go back and forth. But I feel that there is no, it can be interesting. There's no point in that because it's never going to we're never going to get anywhere because they're not being faithful debaters with you, or they're not interested in finding a solution. They're only interested in winning.
This is the problem that I have encountered throughout the last 20 years on a full-time basis, even in courts. The legislation is developed in such a way that you cannot defend yourself. And so they can play the victim. But unfortunately or fortunately, I was a teacher, and I would never give up on a student. And this is because when I studied German at university, German literature, there is that Sturm und Drang period, the storm and stress period, and the concept of youthful sins comes in here, which the Anglo world hasn't really got. This means that, for example, young people do silly things, do stupid things. We must make allowance for this. And some teachers would say, well, you have to smack the brains from the bottom into the head. And this means you have to be patient enough for individuals, young, maturing, developing minds. You've got to give them that opportunity to develop their actual thinking ability. And this means, for example, in a classroom, I would not care whether I liked the students or not. That was irrelevant. What was relevant for me was that the student had the ability to understand and be aware of his thinking, of his understanding developing. And we did this through literature. This is what
Yes, Frederick, you're right, but we're not talking about students or young people. I was referring to, adults, fully adult people.
I'm trying to explain my attitude, why I still have that certain tolerance towards those who are intolerant towards me. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, this is where I was decried as a racist, as a hater. Deborah Lipset was the prime example. She runs around the world. She's a religious Jew at Emory University in Atlanta, and she crosses, she does not debate anyone because as far as she's concerned, they are all haters. And if this is the mindset, the mental attitude, then I'm just astounded and all I can do is simply expose it. And
but my attitude toward Deborah Lipstadt is that there's no point in talking to her. See, there's no point in having a discussion with her. She says she comes right out and says she doesn't want to have one. And really none of them do, unless they want to say what they say. Maybe we should, if you want to say some more about her or that's fine. And then let's go to,
let me, if I may,
yes.
Forget Lipstadt, because her attitude is certainly not academic. And it's just pure bigotry. But the, Gandelman letter I wrote to Mr. Gandelman, and this fellow, he wrote an article, to the 21st century technology makes Holocaust denial easy. And as far as I'm concerned, the whole article drips of German hatred, racial German hatred. It's such a distortion. And so I simply put these points together, and it'll be in the Adelaide Institute newsletter 745, if anyone is interested. The important thing is in my 9 point points made to Mr. Gandelman, the essence is let's look at the facts. And then I had circulated this to a few individuals, and the essence of my rebuttal or elaboration of what I found wanting in this article, because his website is called The Moderate Voice. And I've
Is Joe Gandelman Jewish?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Well, I can't exactly tell by that name, but I just assumed he was.
Yeah.
And he's very, he's very definite about the Holocaust and whatever he said. Well, he says, the Holocaust denial is such a terrible thing. And the internet is making it more possible for people to tell lies. They say, we say they're telling the lies. They turn around and say, we're telling lies about.
Yes, but Caroline, this is where we get into the facts then. My point six in my letter to him, I if I may just read this, I said, what you have presented here is a mixture of assumptions and generalities that are worrisome. For example, did you know that in 1996, Robert Jan van Pelt and Deborah Dwork, in their book, Auschwitz from 1270 to the Present, actually decommissioned the homicide gas chamber at Auschwitz-Stammlager and placed it at Krema 2, Auschwitz-Birkenau. But in 2002, Fritjof Meyer stated that the actual gassings occurred outside the camp in two nearby adjacent farmhouses. Gitta Sereni claimed Auschwitz was not a death camp. These three individuals are all Orthodox Holocaust believers, and they have not been legally prosecuted for so-called Holocaust denial. Your Auschwitz gassing story thus does not stand up to research that has been conducted at Auschwitz. Now, luckily, we have revisionists who are much, much more astute in their knowledge than I am. And our French revisionist comes up with extra points, and I put it in as augmenting this point six by stating the following. The Simon Wiesenthal Center stated there were no extermination camps on German soil. Now, this has to be restated. It's known, but it has to be restated that the Wiesenthal Center admitted this in 1975 and again in 1993. Then Robert Jan van Pelt, the professor at the University of Waterloo, he's an leading expert on Auschwitz. He said that 99% of what we know, we do not actually have the physical evidence to prove. I mean, this is a massive admission, 99%. And he says it has become part of our inherited knowledge. Well, surely this And this
well,
must
yeah, you
force.
Could make, of course, you can make excellent arguments, of course, that completely demolish what they're doing. But does Joe Gandelman care what you've said here? I mean, you've written
Caroline, this him. I know this is.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, it's good to use this method by answering what somebody has written, you know, and say, well, here's this, you know, it's just one method. You could just print this. You could just write about these things without including Joe Gandelman, or you could write to Joe Gandelman and present these facts. But Joe Gandelman's not going to change. He's just going to go and write another one somewhere down the line, more stuff. See, they're not listening. So
okay.
Yeah.
But then we have got the historical record. This is the, I mean, let me just finish with the augmentations. This Jacques Baynac, the French historian, stated in 96, one has to admit that the lack of evidence leads to the inability to establish directly the reality of the existence of homicidal gas chambers. Or Arno Meyer, the European history professor at Princeton, he said, for the study of the gas chambers are at once rare and unreliable. In other words, plans and the extermination of the Jews. It's just not there. And once we know this, this information isn't out there. A lot of people they have that vague notion that the revisionists have the arguments. I mean, it's a truism that the revisionists have won the war on paper, but we just haven't got the political power.
Well, but, we know that. And there's, you know, there's a new website that went up in January in conjunction with the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I'm sure you're familiar with it. But, it has all those arguments there. And people were, there was a lot of traffic there in the very beginning, but now, of course, it's slowed down. And just like with every revisionist site, there's not too many people, you know, generally, you know, there reading it all, unless there's something new coming up. But speaking of the arguments, that's one thing. But in this article by Gandelman, he's got these three photographs. And these three photographs, of course, they can be proven to be not evidence either. But there
yeah,
they are.
Course.
And people look
yeah.
at them and they say, oh, see, well, and then they say, well, there's all this proof of this happening. You know, they don't think about it. And if you're trying to convince thinking Jews, forget it. They're not going to think about it either, even if they're capable of thinking. They don't want to. So the only thing we have is ourselves. Okay.
Not only. This is, you know, when I started in 94 on a full-time basis, I realized that the argument, the revisionist argument, was actually concluded. Most of the work had been done. And what could I contribute to this movement? And I decided that I would have to go and seek the legal clarification. And this is why I had my 97 trip around the world, meeting the revisionists, and then in 99, and of course, meeting for the second time the public prosecutor at Mannheim, and that's where they, for me personally, I mean, it's a funny thing to others ridiculed me for doing this, but I sensed it was a marvelous thing to go to this public prosecutor's office and then ask him to clarify. Of course, he didn't want to clarify anything. He just wanted me to be arrested, because that would send the message to others, look, if this happens, if you question, you go into prison. Well, I didn't mind that. And I think I've said this before, those who are pushing the boundaries, who are doing things like that, if you've done basic boarding school and basic military service, the next thing is prison. You can survive prison. And it was Ingrid Weckert, who in 99, and I attended her court case in Berlin, she had written an article comparing two diary entries from individuals who'd spent time at Auschwitz. One was rather positive, and the other one was, of course, a bemoaning, bewailing story of suffering. And I remember I was sitting in the court, and the prosecutor said, "Why did you do this?" And I couldn't help myself, and I said, "Because she wants to find out the truth." And so that was enough. No, I got a warning from the prosecutor, young, stroppy fellow. You could see that he was blinded. He wasn't only blind in one eye, in both eyes. And he said, if I do that again, I would have to be removed. And another issue arose. And I could see that they were really attacking Ingrid Weckert. And I chipped in again. And so the court was stopped. I was asked to come into the body of the court, and I was sat on a chair, I had to give my particulars. And I apologized for upsetting the court like that. But it was interesting to see that the court outside, there was no name, no judge name, nothing was published. And in the German courts, you do not have a transcript except that which is written by the judge. And so I've exposed these, at least I've become knowledgeable about how the German court system works. For example, at Mannheim in 1999, when I was arrested before the judge, the judge said, he was writing the notes all the time, and then said, would you like to say anything else? And I said, yes, I would like to state that if we found the evidence of the homicidal gas chamber, the murder weapon, we would be the first to publish it. Prosecutor Klein, he jumped up and said, no, that's not necessary. That's not necessary. And I said, yes, it is. And the judge said, would you like it in there or not? And I said, yes, I insist that you put it in, that if we find the murder weapon, or if anybody finds it, we'll publicize it. And of course, Klein, at that time I didn't understand, why was he upset? I thought he was interested in seeking the truth in the court system, through the court system. But now that's what I've learned.
You were since. Naive, weren't you?
Not naive. I was just unknowing, not naive. I knew what I was doing, and I was doing this on purpose to force the issue. This is the point. To force the issue, and there are other matters which what I did before I went to visit the fellow, you would then realize that it was a well-executed plan, and it worked out.
Okay, let's go on to some of these revisionists that you've got. You sent me a PDF that is not published yet. I think for your a newsletter, the Adelaide Institute newsletter for March, and it has some letters from like you have one here from Gerd Honk. What's his last name?
Yeah, Honzig.
Honzig. Yes, the Austrian. And but it's written in German. If you publish that, I guess you want everybody to know about it. So would you tell us about that and what he's writing to you?
Yep.
And
what,
then there's
what
something
happened
here from there's something from you to Horst Mahler, and then there's a card from Gerhard Ittner, and I'd like to talk about him too. So.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Last year when I attended the Wagner Ring des Nibelung in Melbourne, I wrote up about it. And I found that two individuals would be interested in receiving it. At least I thought so. So I sent a copy of newsletter, I think it's 731 A, B, or C, C, I think it is, to Horst Mahler, to the Justizvollzugsanstalt in Brandenburg an der Havel, and to Gerd Ittner in Bayreuth. Of course, Bayreuth, I mean, that's a double take on that, because this is Wagner's home. So
right, this is what we call it Beirut, so people know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, Beirut, there is an interesting little snippet about Beirut. I think it was in the 1890s, the Bayreuth was putting on the Wagner Ring or some Wagner opera, and some equipment, stage equipment, was sent to Beirut in Lebanon. And some people don't realize that it's Bayreuth and Beirut.
Okay.
The Beirut is in Lebanon and Bayreuth is in Bavaria. Okay. So I sent this to the to Horst Mahler, who's in for many years, all because he refuses to believe without thinking about it, about this business. And I receive a letter from the, the Leiter. Who's the Leiter? The administrator, the head, the prison head. And he informs me that the article I sent in has been returned because Mahler did not request it. So Mahler, in order to receive material, written material, must request it. And then you can send it in, and then they'll vet it to see whether it's suitable or not. And they quote...
So you would need to write to him and say, I want to send you this. Please.
Yeah, first to Mahler, would you like to receive this? And then he'll say yes. And then he has to put in an application, and then you
then
may
send...
Then
they might let him see it.
Sorry?
Then they might let him see it.
Oh, maybe, yeah. Well, in fact, I haven't received a note back from Mahler whether this request is going to be made. But I sent the same item to Gerd Honzig, who – not Honzig. I always get the mix up, Gerd Honzig and Ittner, because both of them are really dynamic individuals – who are nationalists through and through. And I'm just like, you know, I'm talking to myself because I've got these papers in front of me. And Gerd Ittner, Justizvollzugsanstalt St. Georgen, Markgrafenallee 49, Bayreuth. He received it, and I scanned his letter, and it's in this Adelaide Institute newsletter.
It's like a beautiful postcard.
Yeah, I like his writing. My handwriting is atrocious, and you know I could never fault students for bad handwriting because I couldn't set an example. So that was sad. Anyway, it's very nicely written. He sends his regards, reciprocates the Christmas greetings, and says that that he was very pleased to receive the Melbourne Ring Cycle report, and then he goes into other things.
He's a very gracious man. He's written to me, it was just beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it just goes to he doesn't do it real fast and just send you some short thing. It's very nice. Where is he anyway?
Well, he's in Bayreuth now. He's in the prison there.
Oh, okay. All right.
And this is the point. He's in the Bayreuth prison. The address is on the envelope in this copy here. And people, it'd be nice if individuals wrote to him.
Yes, because if you send me the if you Skype me or something his address later on. I'll put it on the program.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
I do it myself because I lost track of him.
Yeah, so there we have the two examples of how the prisons differ in approach to receiving material. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ittner says it hurts him. It didn't say it hurts him, but he said he can see the festival. House, the Bayreuth Festival, he can see it from his cell window. And so he has to receive material from Australia connect to the Wagner who's just sort of next door.
That's so sad. And how much more time does he have to serve anyway?
I'm not sure. I think it's
really
about...
really not even guilty of anything. It's just awful.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. It's very much, again, like Honzik. These people are... they were outside Germany, and then they were dobbed in. And that, to me, is an injustice. This is always where I go back to the British common law principle of you being given a right of reply or being given natural justice. If there is a charge against you, then you should be advised of such and not just be snatched up. But there in this common law principle, truth is a defense. Certainly in defamation actions, it's still a defense. But in this Holocaust legislation and in the human rights legislation, as we've seen with Arthur Topham and Zundel in Canada, there it just disintegrates because what matters and what seals the fate of those accused is very much like the witch trials. And I think you remember how there are reports in England that I read where usually it came from the bishop. The bishop would have, that's our rubbish truck just driving past. Can you hear it?
Yes, I did.
He's done his bit. He's coming again, so I don't know what's happening. So when we let, if I may just mention this, the witch trial business, usually you go back to the village, and in a village, some lady gets picked by the bishop to serve the bishop's household. Well, then when this lady reaches a certain age, she has actually started to think, and a lot of men can't cope with this. And so very often, if it's too critical, then this lady would be called a witch. But the bishop wouldn't do it himself. He would send his emissaries into the village, and those who were envious of the lady having made it to the bishop's residence, they would start agitating. And then the court case would begin. The bishop had nothing to do with that. It was the civil authorities who would do it. And so the witnesses would trot in. One would say, I saw her with a broomstick. The other one would say, I saw her consorting with the devil. The other one would say, I saw her having sex with the devil. And then the ultimate, and this is an actual court case, where the document is written out, where it says, and the devil's semen is ice cold. Now, that is enough proof to condemn that woman. And then, of course, she'd be put in a bag and thrown into the river, if the bag floated, then that proved that she's using witchcraft to defeat the just sentence. If she drowns quickly, then that proves that the sentence has been just. Now, that mindset, that mindset we're having today, because I go back to the Adelaide war crimes trials of 1991 with Polyukovich. What one fellow, Mark Ahrens, did was go to the Ukraine, go to the villages and flash around pictures of this Ivan Polyukovich, who was living in Adelaide with his second wife, Maria. The Jews in Australia tried to get the war crimes trials going. So what this Mark Ahrens did was flash that around, said, do you remember any of this? Of course they did, because this Polyukovich, he had left his first wife, who was also called Maria, behind, taken off for Australia, and married another woman. Now, in the evidence in court, it was very critical what the first wife said about the wedding, whether he wore a certain coat, because that certain coat somehow related to whether he was the person that marched Jews into the forest and came back alone. Now, I remember I was sitting there, I listened to this, I thought, this isn't real. This is not real, what I'm listening to. Because the prosecutor then asked a witness, they were all highly paid witnesses, they stayed in the Hilton in Adelaide, and they all returned to the Ukraine and built their double-story homes with what they got from here. And this witness said, yes, I saw him walking. What was the distance? 750 meters. And did you notice anything else? Yes, he was wearing an armband. Now, from 750 meters, you cannot see whether what's on the armband. And luckily, the prosecutor did not ask the witness to go any further. Now, what I saw in this war crimes trials in Adelaide, it was just like the witch trials. And mind you, it was only 91. I hadn't started full time on this Holocaust business, but it was there all the time. And then when we're in front of the court, the same thing happened. I asked the commissioner, first it's the Human Rights Commission, I asked the commissioner whether truth was a defense. And she said something, in these proceedings, we're going according to this and this. I said, please tell me, is truth a defense? And she refused to answer. So I said, if truth is no defense in these proceedings, lies flourish. And therefore, these proceedings are immoral. I cannot participate in immoral proceedings. And I walked out. Well, then this transferred to the federal court. I asked the judge there, Justice Catherine Branson, I asked her, is truth a defense? And she waffled about. And I said, I can't do this. Because in the court case, you then don't talk about matters of fact, but you talk about matters of law. And I'm not a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And only a couple of years ago, I'm still a member of the Australian College of Educators, have been. I'm a life member now. They had their annual meeting, conference, and Branson had become the Human Rights Commissioner in Australia. And I asked her, you know, in your Human Rights Commission framework, where is truth at home? Where is this concept truth, the bedrock of our civilization, this concept? Without that, we cannot function. And of course, the Marxists and others, they don't believe in truth. They say there's no such thing as truth. It's only an opinion. No, matters of fact are truthful. If it's raining, I can say it is truthful that I will get wet or something like that. Yeah. But let me not go on with this.
You know, I'm just looking at these letters, this letter here, Frederick, and I realize that I brought up Gerhard Hanzik, but this is not him. I was misreading this. It says Gerhard Ittner, but the handwriting is such that I thought the two, the I and the T was an H that I just kind of created. And so I thought it was, you had something from both of these men, but this is a letter from Gerhard Ittner.
And the postcard, too,
is from Ittner.
Yeah. What I've got from Hanzik is, I found the old D's item about Holocaust revisionist penitentiary. And Hanzik is on that.
Right, right. But I wasn't even
reading. And also Wolfgang Fröhlich.
Yes, yes. So can you tell us anything more about Ittner? I mean, I interrupted you after I had asked you how much time he still had or what kind of...
I don't know. I think it's it may be a couple of years. I just don't know because I lost contact with him. He when he started moving about.
What did he say here in this letter? Anything?
No. He's quite political in it, but he does not mention.
Yeah, I see. I see the word Ein International. He's saying the international lie, an international lie. I can read that.
Well, should I read it out in German?
Yes. No, not in German, in English.
All right. It's Bayreuth, 1st of February 2014. Okay. Lieber Friedrich, vielen Dank für deine Weihnachtsgrüße.
No, in English. We can read it in German. We need to hear it.
Well, look, I'll read it. Yeah, for your greetings and this Wagner stuff.
Yeah, you don't have to say every word, just in general.
He simply says that it's just a bit ironic that he's sitting in Bayreuth. He has a direct view of the Wagner Festival House. From the Wagner report, he also found out that Vanunu was released in 2013? Because Vanunu's comment was very interesting. He said he kept sane by playing Wagner.
Oh, Mordecai Vanunu. No, I didn't know he was released. Or maybe if I did, I forgot. I don't follow that too much.
Yeah. A little while ago in December, he said the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg handed down a judgment about the Turkish party, Dugu Pir something.
The Turkish
party. Because in 2005.
Somebody sent that to me, and I had one of the very first reports of that on my website, and it sounded great, but I guess it didn't. Hasn't amounted to much. Sounded like a real breakthrough.
He quotes one sentence from that judgment. Such contentious opinions must, in a pluralistic and democratic society, be tolerated. Must be tolerated. So that's the European Court of Justice.
Yes, and I know that Gerd Ittner was interested in taking his case to the European Human Rights Court. And I don't know, I believe I found out that he did and they just rejected him, you know. And I just want, for a long time he didn't have any charges against him, he was just being held in custody while they were trying to decide, you know, what to do with him. And I just wondered if he had finally been charged with something and had a particular sentence that he was.
He says that, 7 years he was in exile, and then he says, well, but that was 9 years ago, so he's already spent 2 years inside.
That sounds right, yes. Yes. And we don't know what's going on with him. He doesn't say, huh?
He wants to continue his political work for free expression. Once he's outside, he'll continue it more intensive than ever.
Yeah, he's a brave person, it seems like. These Germans who are going up against this, you know, in where they live, you know, they all end up in prison, but they're still doing it. Well,
yeah, and he mentions his work from Portugal, and he had a Finnish name. He used to send his emails. Do you remember them? They were good.
No, I didn't get any of that, but I know that Henry Holop was in touch with him quite a bit, and that's where I found out. That's through him I found out about Gerd Ittner and his dilemma, you know, that he had been arrested and brought back to Germany.
Yeah, and he says he's quite positive. He says time will work for us, because the mother of all lies will fall. This is the important thing for individuals, never to resign, never to give up, because we know it's a lie. I think, you know, sometimes individuals ask me, how did you manage 3 prisons and all that stuff? And I said, well, I know because I don't have to fabricate. I don't have to lie. I don't even have to remember. I just have to tell the truth and express my opinions and say, well, look, if you are making these assertions, prove them. The revisionists don't have to prove anything. They have to prove nothing. But what we are doing is pointing out those who believe in the Holocaust, that their expressed belief is more than just that. In many instances, it is an outright lie. As Forreston would say, show me or draw me the homicidal gas chamber, the murder weapon. It has not been done to date.
You know, Frederick, this is, I'm glad you brought this up in this way, because just today, I was sitting here working at the computer, and then I get, you know, daydreaming or thinking about things. And then I had such a strong experience, a realization, like was new. It was a new one, because I do get I do get discouraged. I do get pessimistic, and that anything will ever, you know, straighten out. And then it occurred to me that everything rises and everything falls. You know, I think it was, I was reading some stuff about the stock market. I have to keep up with it every so often. And it was like, well, sometimes it goes down so much you think this is it, this is the end, you know, everything's going to collapse. And then next thing it starts chugging up again. And it's always, things are always going, everything in life is that way. It goes up and down. And I realized, I thought, therefore, the truth about Germany will rise again. It has to, because everything does. You know, it's down so far. It's down in the middle of the earth or something, is down so far in the basement. But then, you know, you think, well, it can never rise again. There's so much against it. But, you know, everything does. Everything.
Now, we've got an author, George Kausch, in Adelaide. He has written a book, Die unbequeme Nation, the uncomfortable nation, or the irritable nation.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, he traces German history back 2,000 years, and he has no time for the religious conquest that occurred in the Germanic nations, because he says, well, they are impulses that come from the Middle East, which is a foreign element, and I concur with that. I've pushed this line. Some individuals are upset when I talk like that, but I say, well, what comes out of Rome and Jerusalem is not for me. I respect that, and as I indicated in one email to you, anyone who makes atheistic comments, I would defend the believer. They're the Christian, the Jew, the Muslim, or the Hindu, because the atheist has intellectual hubris, the rational hubris. And I think my example is always the scholastics, the middle-aged thinkers who try to solve the problem, the particular and the general, in other words, from the physical to the abstract. How do you get there? And they said that the problem was then, how many angels fit on a pinhead? So you've got this concept angel and the physical pinhead, and you're trying to put these two together. And that causes great problems in the mind. British empiricism fell by the wayside and gave away the ideals and said, right, we're going to go from one particular to the next. We're going to go from the physical, and if you're talking about anything, then, well, that's your opinion. This is your free expression, freedom that we grant you, but you're only expressing an opinion. Let's hope you preface anything you say by, I feel that, blah, 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 instead of saying, I think that. Once you say, I think that, it is actionable what you're saying for truth content. But anyway, the French, they went into rationalism, pure and simple, and very often they would develop marvelous mental constructs, which would be really pleasing. But the premise was wrong. on which these in German they say Luftschlösser, castles in the air were built. And so they come crashing down. Now the Germans, with their idealism, would try to improve on both of them, but very often their idealism would swoon into religiosity, not of the accepted religions, but then, for example, the Ersatz religion that was developing under the National Socialists, because Adolf Hitler himself said he would like to turn the Wagner thought structure and music into a religion. And for many, it is a religion because it is so deep, so psychologically profound, what's expressed musically and emotionally and intellectually, that you can't really argue your way out. And we have the newsletter, I think the one previously, the 744, where individuals are really bucketing Wagner because they can't cope with him, because emotionally he's such a force. And that message has to be destroyed through rationalism, but it can't be, as long as people breathe. What was that message?
We're about at the end of the first hour, and we'll be going to our five-minute break and then return again. We've got 30 seconds, but I would like to talk about Wagner when we come back. I've got a few things, and I also want to talk about Heidegger a little bit. So I think we can cover that and then save some time at the end to go into some Veronica Clark stuff that you had in your
yes.
I didn't say it's not yours, but in that newsletter last year in 2000.
Yes.
So we'll be back. So hang around, listeners. Be interested.
I'll get a coffee.
Okay. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. It's February 17th, 2014. And we're into our second hour now. I am here with Dr. Tobin from Adelaide, Australia. And we have been having a pretty eventful conversation here. And we're going to go now into the wonderful talking about Wagner. Now, what is Wagner's first name?
Richard.
Richard Wagner. You know, here's my thought about Wagner. I was thinking today that after I read that article by that Jewish person about Wagner that you sent me, and they're all the same. They're all like that. They go on and on. I think Jews should be banned if we had the power. If once the Germany comes back, a true Germany rises again, all Jewish people should be banned from even writing about Wagner. They have no business writing about Wagner and putting out their stuff. They don't understand Wagner. They don't appreciate Wagner. Some do, but I think they should not even be able to watch his operas or listen to his music. It should be kept away from them. They don't deserve it.
I would disagree with you on that, Caroline.
But it's disgusting to see these things, all the stuff they go on about. And what is most disgusting is Semite business. They think they can go around and label people anti-Semite, and that means something. You know, that we're all supposed to say, oh, that's terrible. Oh, and people are trying so hard not to be labeled an anti-Semite. It makes a person sick, and nobody should play that game with them, is what I feel.
This is the problem when they use the term anti-Semitism, because if you define that term, it falls apart and doesn't work. But at the moment, there is still, this is where my concept of don't blame the Jews only, also blame those that bend to their pressure comes in, where you have individuals who are riding on the Jewish coattails for their own benefits. And they like that because they like to knock the Germans. And it suits them to also propagate the Holocaust matters and other things. There are Jewish individuals, for example, the Asher Fish, he's the conductor, who I've told this story before, I'll tell it again. In 2004, we had the ring in Adelaide, and I was still a member of the Wagner Society in South Australia. And they had a number of functions accompanying the ring's performance, and I attended one Sunday afternoon where Asher Fish was presenting his piece on some Wagner aspect. And afterwards, after the hour or so, I was just standing there. We had a cup of coffee, and he looked at me and said, "Oh, you're Frederick Tobin." I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, I've been warned about you. I've had a look at your website, Adelaide Institute." He said, "I think that's all right." He didn't mind. Now, This is what happens to Jews who immerse themselves in Wagner's music, because Fish tried to perform Wagner in Jerusalem. They hired the Jerusalem University.
I read about him. You know, he likes Wagner. He's trying to get the Israel to accept. I guess Wagner is banned in Israel. I think that's just great. Myself.
But see, this is the point. This is what I object to, and I agree with you on this, that the ones who write negatively, well, then it's our job to write positively. And we had, in Melbourne, we had Heath Lees from New Zealand. He has a CD, four CD collection, where he explains Wagner's music without once mentioning a political thing. Now, this is the excellent thing that needs to be done. This is where the politicization of Wagner is done by pathetic individuals who cannot cope with his thinking structure.
Well, let's face this, though. Let me just say this before you go on, because I would like you to talk about how you see this his structure, because I don't really know what you mean by that. So I would like you to go into that. I'm glad that Wagner was an anti-Semite. And that's, you know, the way they describe it, that you don't like Jews just because they're Jews. No, it's really that you don't like Jews because of what you've seen Jews doing. He knew Jews were rotten to and for Germans, and he was very German. That's one thing he had in common with Adolf Hitler and a lot of people who are on the bad end of things these days and then, too. I'm glad he didn't like Jews. And I don't want to make him Jew-friendly. How are you going to do that? He didn't like Jews, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah. It's not a matter of being Jew-friendly. I have this problem with John Kaminski as well, because he wants to eradicate the Jews. If you realize that individuals who claim to be Jews, they're expressing a thought structure that needs to be augmented. It's limited. And I think Robert Forreston had a Jewish medico in Paris, and I was in contact with him as well, who put it plainly that this mindset, of this non-compromising mindset, this rather primitive mindset, is a result, in the men at least, of circumcision on the eighth day, when two nervous systems within the body have not quite matured or grown, or something happens. There's a whole theory about this. I can't go into it in detail. But the essence of it is that circumcision prevents the sympathetic understanding element within an individual from developing. This medico, this Jewish fellow, that's his point. This is why he opposed circumcision.
What about the women? What about the Jewish women? I mean, I just thought of them.
Well, they would be blessed with the hole in the sheet and the wigs and all that kind of nonsense, which is their tradition. And that is a handicap if you accept this. I mean,
I've never heard of the hole in the sheet before.
Don't you know that book?
No. I don't read about Jews. I'm not interested in them.
Because according to Talmud, the woman is of secondary nature. I mean, the Christians have the disregard. The woman came out of the whatever. I mean, this kind of mythology, the Germanic mythology, gave an equal standing to man and woman. Mm-hmm. This is what Wagner illustrates in his music, in his Ring especially. And the Jews don't have that. The Christians don't have that. And this is fundamental going with nature. And this has been perverted. For example, the Orthodox Jew considers a woman to be dirty. And all that stuff. We don't have to go into that.
No, but you're right. And that reaches over to a lot of areas.
And I worry about this. And once you realize that Wagner in his works is working on this program of eliminating that kind of dichotomy, women are lesser. For example, in Germanic culture, you wouldn't need feminists because they are complementary. This is the Hegelian dialectic worked on this. This, the thinking pattern is there where a man and a woman are balanced. They balance the equation.
That's beautiful. I can't agree. You know, I can't like that more than I do. I mean, that's just perfect.
And this is the essence of Germanic thinking. Therefore, it's totally different to the Semitic thinking that came out of the Middle East in the three religions.
I was just going to say, how do you? You mentioned the Jewish religion and the Christian religion. Well, what about the Muslim religion?
Yeah, well,
you have that same thing.
The Christian religion, as Gamma said on your program before, is merely a sect of Judaism, and so is Islam. So essentially, they are the three Abrahamic religions. They are of one mindset, with differences, regional differences and adaptations. But for the Germanic mindset, they are not fulfilling what is in that Germanic potential. And that is a threat. That is a threat to a lot of people. And if we go back to history, we realize that this Holocaust thing, this Jewish element, is a side issue. The big issue is the Germans are just an irritation to the world because they want to work hard, they want to be clean, they want to be upright, they have ideals and all that stuff. Well, for example, Marxism threw everything out. Marxism does not believe in love, the concept love. They say, oh, that's only sex. No, it's not. This is the point, the full potential of what love is all about is expressed in the ring. And the individuals who don't want the full potential, they can become Valkyries. Or when a woman matures, she can become Erda. And the old fellow, Wotan, he can wander about and be the old wanderer and just observe and see how things are crashing down on him. It's so beautifully put with music. It's so,
Have you written all this down, Frederick? And I mean, I haven't seen, I know that you talk about Wagner a lot and write about Wagner, but I haven't seen you put all this together. Not quite, but
I've got you as a good listener.
Oh well, I'm fat. I like it very much.
But let me just get back to this other point of the Hegelian dialectic and the Talmudic dialectic. We have to remember. We have to get back to Talmud, Tanakh, Old or New Testament. It's all the similar mindset. It's a similar mindset. It is the mindset against the rest and not with nature. If we're with nature, for example, Wagner, this is what disturbed me in Melbourne when I saw the subtitles on the screen accompanying the singing. Whenever Wagner or whenever the Wotan or others talked about Geschlecht or Stammbaum, or clan or family tree, they guess what they put in the Barry Millington, who doesn't like Wagner as such, but he translates these concepts into race. Now that ties in nicely with hatred of Wagner because he was a racist. But it wasn't. It is the concept of the Völkische, the idea of what the folk is all about. And this is they're trying to kill and destroy in the German people. This is...
I know. They seem to be succeeding,
then,
too.
Yeah. And then we would become rootless, uprooted, like those who propagate Judaism, and their only hold is Talmud. And that's a commentary to Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmud, and that is a commentary. Someone... beautifully dismisses it as saying, well, there is the golden rule or the Kantian categorical imperative, act in such a way that your actions can become a universal law, therefore don't kill because you don't want to be killed. Payback time and all that stuff. But in the Talmud, it is a death dialectic. It is them and us. It's win-lose. Now, in philosophy, I never wanted to win or lose. I wanted to clarify. I wanted to understand what on earth is going on. Because as a youngster, I couldn't express myself. I sensed the instinct was there. luckily I was brought up on a farm and I was with nature. and therefore I sensed things when I went to university. I mean, it was in the 60s and there were all sorts of different, I joined the liberal club because that was all we did was have barbecues and have sort of fun, while the Labour Party, they drummed Marxism into us, into their followers. And I couldn't take that because the point they made was, well, we want the dictatorship of the workers, workers of the world unite and all that stuff. I could sense that it didn't sound right. It wasn't real. And so it was wondering about trying to understand what life was all about. And then you went back to the values that your parents imbued you with. And that was basic honesty, basic uprightness, cleanliness, eating properly, sitting at the table with good manners and so on. And you know, nowadays we have the younger generation, they don't know where to go. And you have individuals, and I'm glad there are individuals, young individuals coming through the revisionist scene who sense things aren't going right. They know they're being told lies by their parents or by their uncles and aunts and by their teachers. They sense this, and that's my hope that, you know.
So then they go out and drink a whole lot in order to dull the pain, I guess.
Yeah, well,
I don't think they're reacting all that well to it, but let's
see. I know, but many of them do dull their pain by being hedonistic, by having a good time and then having good fun and then having sense gratification, which leads to nihilism and self-destruction. Therefore, it is much better to self-destruct with Wagner because then at least you're not a burden to anyone else. You can seek refuge in the Wagner societies if they let you in.
Well, Fred,
many of them are run by Jews, unfortunately.
I know. That's why I think Jews should be kept out. We can't do that, but if we could do that, that's what
It means that the ones who, if a society is run by Jews, where are the non-Jews asserting themselves? This is the point. The parasitic thinking of attaching yourself, that's what they've done with Wagner. They've attached themselves and they want to now pervert Wagner to express that which he didn't express. And all you have to go is back to his works.
Well, now, you're very Wagnerian and so on. And would you consider yourself, Frederick, anti-Christian? You don't like Christianity particularly. What about Hitler's thinking that you could have a German Christianity? He was all for those German Christians who said they were behind that and going to create a German Christianity and a German Christian church, and then move forward in that way, because the Germans are very attached. Well, they were at that time, not so much now, I guess, to being Christian.
Now the Germans are attached to Holocaustianity. And but if you look at the situation, Caroline, the German years under the National Socialists was moving towards that kind of goal, and it would have taken generations. This is a generational plan of moving towards the Germanic mindset. And it's very difficult because there are too many people, even the aristocrats are attached to Christian elements, as the culture is. And you can see that in cultural expressions. But it would take time, and this is what the movement was all about. It would take generations. Mm-hmm. The atheistic element coming in, it is mainly run by Jewish interests, Dawkins, for example, the great atheist who's doing the rounds in the world, propagating atheism as such and hopping into all the religions, but he believes in Holocaust. So what have we got there then? You see, this is what they do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They're never going to change it either. That's the problem with talking to Jews, thinking that you're going to, you know, there are some of these good Jews and
there are plenty
and that, so on.
Yes, but Carolyn, again, it's a generational thing. There are plenty of individuals who don't want to play the victim, who are sick and tired of playing the Holocaust victim for 50, 60, 70 years. They want to get out of this. There are many Germans who have left their Jewish religion behind. They are Germans. This does happen.
No, they think. So they say, I don't see him doing anything to help Germany.
At the moment, it's still fashionable to find your Jewish grandmother. Someone said to me, I would have been more fortunate. Goodness me, let me just break that up.
Okay. And then we want to talk about Heidegger. Are you there or are you still gone? Okay, there's an article about Heidegger. I'll just tell the listeners right now that I don't know why people don't just turn their phone off when they're on. In March next month, these black books called the Heidegger's Black.
I've just been out of the room. Go ahead. I didn't hear what you're saying.
I was starting to talk about Heidegger's black books.
Yep.
That we're going to talk about that next. So after you finish up what you were saying there.
Yeah. Now, you see, isn't it beautiful? I hate it when my mind does things like that. I was going to mention this business about writing to Jewish individuals, and I immediately got a lot of criticism, not a lot, four or five people wrote in responding to my email to this Gandelman thing. I'm reminded of Robert Fisk, the Middle East correspondent, who has been following the Lebanese situation for 20, 30 years. He said one important point when he came to Australia. He said, what's happening there is, there are so many different factions fighting one another. There are on the ground, while the politicians, they're speaking with each other. This is the point. I think if we seal off the dialogue from our end, it cannot be productive. This is where free expression is a
universal
thing.
I think we should have a dialogue with ourselves and leave out the Jews, because it's constantly, they jump in everywhere. Now, the one thing that we understand at the White Network is that the Jews want to get in. They want to get in everywhere. They don't want anything going on that they cannot get into and have their voice and speak their mind and be a part of. And when you keep them out, of course, they're not bothering us. But, bigger things, they would go crazy if they were kept out of, you know, main things, you know, things that they want to be in. So, but I think that we can only have a proper dialogue if they're not there, because they come in order to turn things in their direction.
Well, to disconnect and upset.
Yes. Or even if they want to be a part of it, somewhere along the line, it's just they're not a good influence.
It's not only Jews, it's anybody who would disagree. This is where I say
no, but you have to allow disagreement, but it should be disagreement among similar people. We have plenty of disagreement. That's okay. That's, you know, what the kind of disagreement we should be dealing with. We shouldn't be, I think it's a waste of time to be talking. And you know what else I thought today? I thought that if you could, if you, if, if I, if, if it could be done that you banned Jews from writing about Wagner, and you banned Jews from listening to Wagner, if there was such a, you know, such a thing could be done, and then you banned them from white society, they, you know, what would happen? All these Jews would stop being Jews, because they don't want to be on by themselves. They want to come in and dictate to the rest of us what we're supposed to be doing and thinking.
Yeah, but if you let it happen, Caroline, what we must not do is bend to their pressure. This is the important point.
Well, you know, that's not, it's not that easy when they have all the power. But if you actually,
I know, but
if you actually didn't allow them to participate, all these Jews would say, I don't want to be a Jew anymore, and they would throw away their Jewishness so that they could continue to be a part of the world. But so far, the rest of the world, but so far, they are able to do it.
Caroline, this is what happened when the economic situation came to a crash in the 20s, last century, when the National Socialist Movement began. People realized who was behind the money system. People realized that this was, in effect, that the death dialectic of Talmud, where Jewish interest, and I think we've got that little illustration about boycotting Germany and so on, and who started it. This, we would only be following or falling into an abyss if we banned. We are matching ourselves against the mindset, the Jewish mindset, and we are far clearer. We are, look what Wagner did. Go on.
Well, I just don't, you know, I just think that's a kind of a, it's not going to happen that way. In fact, Horst Mahler talks like that too. And I don't care for it too much. Because he says,
do you think it's an intellectual wank?
Well, I guess, you know, I understand the idea. Well, you don't want to ban people. You want to silence people. You don't want to do these things. But I don't see anything wrong with it. I think it's the only way for some people to save themselves. It's a way for us to save ourselves, because, you know, we've got an enemy that is stronger than we are at the moment. But anyway,
Caroline, let me just follow this up, because this is what I like about your program. You do not incite. You are clarifying your position, while others who are talking similarly, there seems to be this incitement, which is exactly what they're looking for, because laws will then be developed, or are being developed, or exist already, to grab that element, that impulse, and then they nip it in the bud and it's gone. But let me just go to South Africa. I was there in the 70s and in Rhodesia, and I saw how a minority tried to uphold a system that needed a majority to keep going. 300,000 whites running 6 million blacks in Rhodesia. And Jews were right in on this, as they were in South Africa, 4 million whites with 20 million blacks. And the Jews were running South Africa, as they still do now, although they've got the token blacks running the political scene. In effect, it's nothing much has changed, except that the whites and the blacks at the bottom are suffering more. During the apartheid regime, the blacks were better off than they are now. And this is one hope, that this is why I liked what Robert Mugabe was doing in Zimbabwe. He brought in a nationalism that, and then you could see how the international financial resources crushed him and eliminated the Zimbabwe dollar. And now the U.S. dollar rules supreme there, for the time being at least. But you can see how the whites could not hold this, because they relied on blacks. We had whites who enjoyed the lifestyle of servants and everything, and yet they would disparagingly refer to their servants. This is, it's like, well, it's the pain of colonialism in some respects, or feudalism in England, for example. The whites had this done to their own. The whites were doing it to whites as well. And I think, isn't it Michael Hoffman who talks about the white slaves in America? Instead of focusing only on the blacks, what about the white slaves? And now today I would talk about the white slaves or the financially enslaved individuals all over the world. And when we talk about that, then we've got the problem of how to focus that energy that objects to this into a channel. And there isn't much except that individuals can clarify things for themselves and then stand firm when the system knocks them out or tries to knock them out. I mean, this is what I've tried to do. I've tried not to bend to any pressure. I've apologized to the court, and in the newspaper they tried to make out that I gave a Holocaust apology. I didn't. I apologized to the court because I upset them. Well, that's a gentlemanly thing to do, but certainly I would never apologize for what I was thinking, because I know that my thinking is that there is nothing wrong with it, but it may be threatening to those who see in this kind of thinking a threat to their existence.
Okay. Now it's 9:32, so let's get on to Martin Heidegger, because I would like to say a few things about him. And you wrote, yeah. I don't know if this is written, you wrote something about him, and then there is something written.
No, I didn't.
This, Robert Zaretsky.
Yeah.
Well, this is, well, who wrote this thing ahead of Robert Zaretsky's article?
That was mine.
Yes, I thought so. It's very good. And I've got it here in front of me, and I've got Robert Zaretsky's article too. And I was informed by this that these black books, by what they call the Black Notebook or something, the Black Notebooks,
yep,
by Martin Heidegger, that had not been found before or translated or something, are coming out in March. I suppose a lot of people know what's in them, but then they will be published. And now the Jews are talking a lot about this already, because he was an anti-Semite. And now Martin Heidegger is a highly respected philosopher, German, and he lived during contemporary there with the National Socialism and Adolf Hitler, and I guess he was a member of the National Socialist Party, was he, Frederick?
I don't know. I just know that he was the rector of the university, and people. Yes, this is, he highlighted the divide among the Germans intellectuals as well.
Mm-hmm.
But his thinking was strong enough to overcome all that, to overcome the Christian and Jewish conceptual framework and emerge through all this and develop his philosophy. That was the interesting thing for me.
Well, he, he is considered anti-Jewish. It's questionable whether he should be called an anti-Semite or not, but they are worried now because he kind of, overcame the National Socialist thing. It's like, well, he wasn't really a National Socialist, and because he was so brilliant, a lot of, others, like in France, French intellectuals supported him. For the most part, he became very popular in France. And this, it goes, Robert Zaretsky's article covers all of that. I found it very interesting. But he is, of course, saying that, oh, Heidegger, though, has this fatal flaw you know, that seemed like he was anti-Semitic. And I just find that, you know, like hilarious, again, and irritating that, you know, they think that they can say if somebody doesn't fit the profile of getting, you know, thinking well of Jews, then there's something terribly wrong with them and they can't be acceptable and everybody has to reject them, and this is what they want. They're wanting all the philosophy departments and so on, universities, whatever, to reject him now that this stuff is coming out, what it's going to reveal. And it says right here, there's one person who is a supporter, a former student of Heidegger, Victor Farias, that's, I think, French, a Frenchman too, published a book, Heidegger and Nazism. And he revealed that Heidegger's decision to join the Nazi party, so he did join it, was not, as his defenders claimed, opportunistic, but instead principled.
Isn't it beautiful? Isn't it wonderful to be acting on a principle and not being opportunistic like many Jewish individuals or non-Jews?
Right.
Opportunism.
The thing that they hold against it. Oh, if he was just being opportunistic in that time when everybody had to be a national socialist in order to get ahead, and he was running this university and so on, writing, you know, doing his philosophy work and so on, well, then that was okay. But if he really believed it and really thought it was the right thing, then that is not okay. But they're having a hard time with the idea that he didn't really believe it, because he did. So he stepped down.
But Caroline, this is what I find interesting in the article, that he admits this. I mean, someone who's opportunistic or is principled, this means that it's a matter of values. Now, who do you prefer? Do you prefer a principled person or somebody who's opportunistic?
Well, I prefer a National Socialist person.
Exactly. And therefore he is principled, and that is his belief, and he acts accordingly.
Well, I'm very excited. I'm very happy that these books are coming out, or this book, whatever, and that it's going to show more of his belief in National Socialism, and that he was said things negative about Jews. I'm very glad, because he is a great mind, and no matter how much they can call him an anti-Semite, you can't take away his brilliance and the great influence he's had on the intellectual thought of contemporary, you know, philosophy.
Yeah.
Here's a line where it says at the end, towards the end, that this is by the author here, this Zaretsky, who's Jewish. He's got to be Jewish. He says Heidegger was anti-Semitic. In a letter to a colleague in 1935, he deplored the presence of Jewish and half-Jewish students in his classes, and in his seminars declared that Semitic nomads were impervious to the German spirit. Well, I applaud that.
Well, that is it's stating a basic fact that the nomadic way of thinking is opportunistic. While if you're sedentary, if you are, if you have to face nature at its best within a community, within a folk, then you cannot be opportunistic. You have to have principles. You have to have values that are firm. You have to have a belief system that sees you not only through your 70 but also the subsequent generation is looked after. Generational thinking comes in here. These are all the things. This is what not many understand, that this National Socialist movement was one that worked on a generational thought pattern. And of course, this is why they, for 70 years, they've tried to destroy it with everything. They've thrown everything at this thought structure, but it's still there because it's rooted in nature, in natural processes, and that you cannot eliminate. But at the same time, I think Arthur Butz said the problem with the Jewish mindset is it's like the parasite. If the parasite kills the host, it too dies. So the Jewish mindset is always in a bother. It can never come to rest because it is not at home. Mm-hmm. And this is the important point of what I'm trying to do, or for myself personally, to have that home within your own mind, to know that you are at one with nature, and that, in other words, we are in the universe. We are at one. We are not the absolute, as the Talmud says, these pronouncements of hatred that come out of Talmud, or even the Old Testament. I can just mention this one thing. My ex-wife was a Catholic, and we had a son, and in time she wanted him to be believe it or not, be conversant with the Bible. So I started reading the Bible. Before that, she had read him lovely fairy stories, and he would go to sleep smiling. Big grin on his face, he would then drop off to sleep. Yet, when I started reading the first two pages of the Bible, there was this hatred against the Egyptians, and I said, what's going on? And you could see he was tensing up, and I said, this is not for children. This is a hate book. And I could not continue.
Okay.
Okay. All so right. That's the message to the Christian fundamentalists in America. If they want to do any good, they had better start listening to Wagner's music and then immersing themselves in that beautiful music. And that will be liberation, freedom. This is what Wagner's music is about.
It is amazing music. It's just unlike anything. Nothing has ever come about.
And you'll see critics will say Wagner was he was a fraud, Wagner was a cheat, Wagner was dishonest.
I know.
And all sorts of things.
Yeah, except he could write the most beautiful music
They're also trying to point out that he was a philanderer, he had lots of women, rubbish. If you're as sensitive as he is, and he had shingles in his face because he was such a nervous a person, an individual in contact with the world, you can't cope with more than one woman. You can't have a harem of whatever, because you've got to have that energy. In any case, our society, you know, this is where we're running afoul. We're saying enjoy yourself have, I don't know how many partners and all that stuff. This is all hogwash. Because if you want to produce something, if you want to do something solid, well, in the Germanic sense, and I think the Romans wrote about it when they fought the Germans, if a man fell and the wife was in the area, she'd pick up his spear and run towards them. They'd be strong enough to knock the Romans out.
You know, you were talking about being in the world, being a part of the universe. So I'm going to read another quote from this, but I want to also mentioned that the author of this, it's just the writer of this article about Heidegger, whose name is Robert Zaretsky, I see here at the bottom, he's a professor of history at University of Houston here in Texas.
Yep.
And he wrote the book, A Life Worth Living, Albert Camus and the Quest for Meaning. But I learned just recently that Albert Camus was a big Holocaust believer. I mean, a big pusher and advocate of. So I guess he was Jewish. You know, I was so familiar with Albert Camus and the other. Now I can't even think of the name of that. Who am I? That movement.
I'm not familiar with him.
Oh, you're not. Oh, well, you know, Sartre and that whole group.
Yeah, but Sartre was a nitwit.
I know. They all are. But see, when I was young, these were the ones that were
Let me just mention this one thing. Sartre tried to make out that jealousy and envy, that kind of things should be switched off. So his woman, the woman he was with, Simone de Beauvoir, she wrote in her autobiography that it hurt her to know that he was cavorting with other, with men. It hurt her. She had to admit she did not overcome this, as the Marxist tried to make out that we should overcome these basic feelings where fidelity is nothing, where faithfulness means nothing. And I mean, this is Sartre's whole thinking. This is what split Wagner from Nietzsche. Nietzsche was a homosexual, and he could not cope with Wagner's musical genius as such, but he was very good intellectually. This is my example of someone who has a brilliant mind and can demolish theoretically anything, but it's not a fact. And Wagner distanced himself from Nietzsche because of that. So these are the little background information.
And so often these men who have this, we have to be supermen. We have to be, you know, we're the best. We men. They are homosexuals.
But these macho, this macho image is such a nonsense. You have, and I noticed this, that's the Anglo background, the Anglo-Australian, American, this macho kind of person. You don't have that in Germany. You have extremely sensitive men. If they came to Australia, they'd say, oh, you're just you're gay or whatever. But they're not. They are just sensitive. And this is what a woman loves, to yes. have that sensitivity. And this, now I'm being trivial, but this whole business about stressing about men reaching 50 and so on, and then prostate cancer and all that stuff. Well, I say this is the macho man's revenge.
On the macho man.
No, I got it wrong. It's the female revenge on the macho man. Mm-hmm. Because then suddenly I know so many fellows who've had the operation and they're now leaking and all that stuff.
Well,
blah,
we've
got to
move on here.
Blah.
Okay, the one more thing I'll say. I was going to say that in this article, the author Zaretsky wrote, a quote from somewhere? Unlike the German nation, Jews will always be uprooted. This is from Heidegger. Heidegger wrote this. Jews will always be uprooted from being in the world. In a word, the Jew is persona non grata. Well, then he says, in a word, the Jew is persona non grata, not just in Hitler's world, but in Heidegger's world as well. And this is what I think they should be. And this is what they hate more than anything. And that's why this guy is complaining about it. That you can't make the Jew persona non grata, that's, you know, that's Hitlerian. And Heidegger was doing it too. I applaud, I think that's just great. I am glad you put this article in here. And I've learned a lot from it, Fred. And I'm gonna follow through on some of these ideas. But now that we only have a few minutes left, we have to turn to, Veronica Clark real quickly. And you are going to explain why you put what you did in an issue, in one of the newsletters, practically the whole thing, 20 pages of her black Nazi stuff. And she wrote to me before this show saying, Mr. Tobin has not removed this from his website, that newsletter. And she wants to know, is it because you endorse her? And you find what her work useful.
Yeah.
You for putting that in there in my little way.
To that, I simply say, Veronica wrote me an email to say that, or to Adelaide Institute, and she said she hates her work being used by Nazis and other. She used derogatory terms, and I said, If she takes legal action for us to remove this, then we would counter that with a defamation action, because I didn't like the way she labeled us like that. And so I'm just waiting for her action. But I certainly found the work interesting, and we publish interesting work. We have the Earls there, so individuals who read the stuff, they can inform themselves. It looks genuine. I haven't gone into it. But Mr. Peter Hartung of the Adelaide Institute has left it on there because it's of general interest. And so the veracity or the authenticity of her statements, I haven't checked up, and nor has Peter. But you said you knew her more. I just know she is claiming to be in an asexual commune, living in an asexual commune. And I wrote an item or a commentary, I think it was on your thing, on your blog, that there's no such thing.
Now I remember what you wrote. That there's no such thing as asexual.
Yeah, unless it's a physiological one. But Parzival also, the opera Parzival, talks about this, where a certain gentleman castrates himself. And when I traveled to America in 1977 in April, there was a commune in California led by a 70-year-old. He castrated himself, and he had young men following him. They did the same. They wanted to reach deeper spiritual heights by doing that. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is an absolute nonsense, and it is a perversion of the natural instinct of procreation, of living within that life-giving impulse. And it's dishonest. It's intellectually dishonest to write like that. But this is the trend. This is what is done when people reach a certain age. They can't function anymore. And then they sublimate it. They say, oh, yes, well, this is the virtue. We don't want that anymore. Or they've led such a shonky, terrible life, being abusive to all sorts of people. And they realize this. And now they want to make up for it. That, to me, is intellectually dishonest. And so I don't know what Veronica Clark has done.
You know, what I had said what you had said and what so many people say is that, well, it looks like it's good work that is counteracting the idea that Hitler's Germany was such a terrible racist place and so on. I think it would be better to counteract those kinds of accusations with a better explanation of why nationalism and why people should stick with their own race, rather than to say, oh, well, they had a lot of other races there, because it really isn't true. And the thing about all of that material that you had there is that if you actually did read it all and go through it all, you would find that it doesn't back up what she says, and that she exaggerates a diversity, as she calls it. And she finds a few examples, and then she jumps from that to that it was, you know, widespread and so on, and makes a lot of claims. And also, a lot of those pictures are not relevant and don't prove anything. So...
Yeah, Caroline.
What I complain about is people just generally looking at that and saying, "Well, this is interesting. This must be good or something," and then promoting it in some way.
Now, Caroline, what I see in that is a parallel with the Jesse Owens item in 1936.
And I'm tired of hearing about that too. You know, everybody brings that up.
I know, but the racist concept, Caroline, the racist concept is still seen as a negative instead of a positive because of these interpretations. And one has to differentiate these things to indicate that the Germans were only interested in the Germans in the Germanic mindset, not the others. They were extremely tolerant towards the others. And those who wanted to join they are still hospitable towards the others, but not the ones who were dismantling the Germanic mindset.
Well, that's very well put, Frederick. Now, that's perfect what you said, and I know you do understand it very well. But what she is actually ending up with is that it's going to be a blend of all these mindsets, you know, and that the Germans are not a particularly unified people, or they're not a race. And 60 seconds already. Well, so
That's the nonsense. The Germanic mindset is extremely strong.
I really like what you've said tonight about the German mindset. I really do. You make very strong statements about it. And I know we're on the same page, and you're way ahead of me in understanding a lot of these things the way you put them. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. And I think it's been a very interesting program. What would you like to say to the listeners before we are cut off?
Yeah, well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. As I said, we've clarified things, and the Germanic mindset is there to stay. It'll always be contested, as is usual, in the battle of the wills.
Wonderful.
And we just have to continue.
That's wonderful. And we will continue. We do continue. And so, ladies and gentlemen, continue to listen to my program and come back again next week. Thanks for listening tonight.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.